विशन महाग्ने पुरुषार्ध दर्शनाद असत सभाय वानवाश कृच्छ्रतः मृधे मृधे नेक महारथाश्रतो द्रोण्याश्रताश्चाज्म हारे विराक्षित. My dear Krishna, your lordship has protected us from a poison cake, from a great fire, from cannibals, from a vicious assembly, from suffering during our exile in the forest, and from a battle where great generals fought. And now you have saved us from the weapon of Ashvatam. Vipada shandu tat sashvat tatra tatra jagat guru bhavato darshanam yad syad apurna bhava darshanam. I wish that all those calamities would happen again and again so that we could see you again and again. For seeing you means that we will no longer see repeated births and deaths. Janmaishvarya shuta shubhir edhamana madapuman naivar hatya bidhatum vai tvamakinchana gocharam. My Lord, your lordship can be easily approached, but only by those who are materially exhausted. One who is on the path of material progress, trying to improve himself with respectable parentage, great opulence, high education, and bodily beauty, cannot approach you with sincere feeling. So this is the next verse in that series. Of verses by Kunti Devi. These are actually assembled into a book called The Teachings of Queen Kunti. But they come from this section. As we said yesterday, that Krishna had been with the Pandavas all the time, basically, from the episodes where Duryodhana tried to kill them when they were younger, to the episode of them being in the forest for a while, hiding out, then winning Draupadi, then gaining Kandava Prastha, which became Indra Prastha. Then they had their kingdom gambled away, Draupadi was insulted, and finally the Battle of Kurukshetra was fought. And after the Battle of Kurukshetra, they were protected from Ashvatthama. So Krishna had been with the Pandavas, more or less, had spent a lot of time with him throughout this whole episode. And Kunti is kind of able to understand that at this point, it appears their life is smooth sailing. And for the most part, it is. Because from this point forward, the Battle of Kurukshetra has been fought, Duryodhana has been vanquished, and there's no threat on the horizon. So Kunti intuitively knows that Krishna is going to go back to Dwarka, and Krishna is going to manage the kingdom that has been assembled by him. Krishna, of course, was originally, he had his early pastimes in Vrindavan. And then he was summoned to Mathura Dham. And there in Mathura, he was challenged by Kamsa, first by wrestlers, by an elephant, and by all so many different things. And Krishna defeated the elephant, the wrestlers, and finally he killed Kamsa himself. And then there was a series of attacks by Jarasandha and Kaliyavana and others in Mathura. And Krishna felt that the closeness of Mathura to Vrindavan made it dangerous for the residents of Vrindavan, because Krishna had come, as he says in Bhagavad Gita, Parachanaya Sadhunam Vinashayat Chaduskritam Dharma Samstapanartaya Sambhavami Yuge Yuge. And he also says, Yada Yadahi Dharmasya Glanir Bhavati Bharata Bhutanam Adharmasya Tadatmanam Srijamiyam. That whenever there is a decline in religion, a rise in irreligious principles, at that time I come to annihilate the demons and to deliver the pious, as well as to reestablish the principles of religion. So Krishna had come to annihilate the demons, and there were a number of them on the earth at that time. The earth was overcrowded with demons, so Bhumi Devi asked Lord Brahma to do something. And they went to the milk ocean and performed Purusha Shukta. And then the answer came in Brahma's heart from Kshirodakshaya Vishnu, who's in the middle of the milk ocean. And it was responded that Krishna would soon appear. And he did appear as, the son of Devaki and Vasudeva. Of course, he actually grew up in Vrindavan as with Yashoda and Nanda Maharaj as his foster parents. And so Krishna, he saw that there was too many kings that were inimical to him. Kamsa had a great network of allies, and that's why Kamsa was so powerful and so arrogant, because he felt that nobody could challenge him. So when Kamsa was killed, then many other demons who were friends of Kamsa, they came against Krishna. But Krishna wasn't living in Vrindavan, he was living in Mathura. So Krishna thought, this is too dangerous for the residents of Vrindavan, that all these antagonistic kings attacking me all the time. I should move somewhere where the residents of Vrindavan are not in danger by these people coming to try to kill me. So Krishna erected the Dwarka fort within the ocean. It was not actually in Dwarka, it was off the coast. And the fact that it was an island meant that it was difficult for people to attack it. It was not so easy to conquer. And, of course, Krishna went on fighting many different kings and arrogant followers of Kamsa and such. He went on fighting them, but he did it in Dwarka. So Kunti Devi knows that Krishna's going back to Dwarka. He's not going to be with them. And she's lamenting this change of things, and she's wishing that there could be some other catastrophe about to happen so Krishna would stay there with them. And this is Krishna's general way of operating, that he's sometimes with the devotees and sometimes he leaves the devotees. He was with the gopis for such a long time, and then he left the gopis. And now he was with the Pandavas, and now he's leaving the Pandavas. So we have this idea that there is Samboga and Vipralamba. Samboga is when Krishna comes together with the gopis or the devotees in general. And there's an enjoyment of being actually with Krishna. And Vipralamba is what happens when Krishna departs. And the devotees feel a sense of intense separation, which is said to be actually even higher. Because since Krishna is everywhere and Krishna is everything, it's impossible to be separated from Krishna in fact. But, of course, the devotees, they want to be in the association of Krishna's Bhagavan expansion, his personal expansion. So whenever he leaves, they feel a sense of loss. And Kunti Devi's understanding that that's what's about to happen. So she's approaching Krishna, and she's offering these feeling prayers. And she's making this point, Janmaishvarya Shutashrim here, Edhamanamatam Madapuman Naivarhati Abhidhatum Baitwama Kinchana Gochuran. These are quite famous verses, actually. Janmaishvarya Shutashrim here, Edhamanam Madapuman Naivarhati Abhidhatum Baitwama Kinchana Gochuran. That my dear Lord, one who is actually trying to advance himself with wealth, great parentage, education, and so they cannot call upon you feelingly. You are the property of those who are bereft. Oh my Lord, your Lordship can be easily approached by only those who are materially exhausted. One who is on the path of material progress, trying to prove himself with respectable parentage, great opulence, high education, bodily beauty, cannot approach you with sincere feeling. So one thing that stands out in this verse, and that's what I'm going to speak about this morning, is the notion that spiritual life can only start when you are hopeless about material existence. As long as one is actually bright with the prospect that somewhere around the corner material happiness is there, as long as one thinks like that, one will never take to spiritual life. And that's actually why most people can't be bothered with any kind of religion, and why most people find that when they come in contact with devotees or devotional process, they're wholly unattracted to it. Because the prospect of material happiness shines brightly in the core of their heart. And as long as one is convinced there is such a thing as material happiness, as long as one's convinced that it can be gotten by simple material means, then spiritual life is out of the question. It's really out of the question. It can never happen. And that's why oftentimes when people come to material bankruptcy in one way or another, when things just bottom out, at that point, spiritual life starts for them. Not everybody works that way, but oftentimes it does work that way. And why is that? Because we build our whole concept of life based on the advancement of material existence. Even if people are coming from a Vedic background, there's this idea that one gets, as we know, the four goals of life, dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. So one performs dharma. Why? So that one can get artha, material benefit. So one performs religious rituals or dharma so that one can get material benefit, artha. And then with the material benefit, one can get what they really are after, which is kama, material desires. So these are generally thought to be the goals of life. And then occasionally a rare person transcends beyond that and decides liberation is what they want, moksha. But mostly people don't have any conception of what liberation is. So liberation is kind of a fuzzy and nebulous affair. And people imagine that liberation is getting free from pain, or they imagine liberation is getting free from form, or they imagine liberation is being able to become united with some mystic state of consciousness. And so people have these various false conceptions of what liberation is. But some people are done with material acquisition, but they're not yet ready to start spiritual life. So they fall in this nether middle category between the two. They're not really able to any longer entertain any faith that material happiness is something worth working for. But at the same time, they haven't understood the Supreme Lord. So they're after some mysterious rainbow that they're looking for. And they think of it in various terms. Some people think of it as being free from suffering. Some people think of it as being free from all form. Some people think of it as being mystically aware of something or another. Some people think of it as some kind of unspeakable conscious state. And, you know, they chase this rainbow for some time. But there's also another false notion. So this main point here is that this is one of the reasons why the Supreme Lord, he brings a person sometimes to the bottom of the material spectrum. We want to be somewhere on the top with, because if one has opulence, well, then one can enjoy, you know, the material world. But if one is bereft of opulence, one cannot enjoy the material world. And that's usually the point where spiritual life really begins. There's a famous story of the Brahmin from Avantipur, which is, I think, in the 11th or 12th canto. I'm not remembering which one. But he was a wealthy, although he was a Brahmana, he was somehow involved in agriculture. And he had a lot of opulence at his disposal. But he had a fault, a character flaw. And that character flaw was he was a miser. And he would not spend money on anything. He didn't pay his taxes. He didn't spend money on his family. He didn't worship the demigods. He certainly didn't worship the Supreme Lord. And he didn't even spend money on himself. You know, some people, they're just happy knowing that they have a big number in the bank, and that's all it is, you know. They don't even get around to doing anything with that wealth, you know, transferring the artha into kama. They don't even get to that step. They're just happy knowing that there's this big sum of money associated with their name. And so that's usually called being a miser. So, of course, because he behaved in this way, his family hated him, and because he behaved in this way, he certainly wasn't getting the mercy of the demigods. And even eventually, because he didn't pay his taxes, the government was going to come after him. So it's said that because he lost the favor of the demigods, the crops failed, and he couldn't pay his debts. And little by little, the family arranged to steal some of the money, and they left him. And the government came, put him in jail for having evaded his taxes. And in this way, in a short time, he lost everything. And he was the bottom of the heap at that point. And while he was at the very nadir of his whole existence, a strange thing happened. And that strange thing was that he realized that this was actually the favor of the Supreme Lord. And a great wave of renunciation came over him. And he thought, I must have accidentally done something that pleased the Supreme Lord, because he was merciful upon me and took everything away. And since he took everything away, I realize that this yellow stool that I've been working for my whole life is worthless, and that I have been giving my whole life to protecting this fortune, to trying to advance myself in material development. But actually, this has no value. And the difficulty I have encountered in trying to do this I have been mercifully delivered from it by being delivered from my opulence. And now I have, come to the point where I realize that this is some kind of favor of the Supreme Lord. So now I am diligently going to engage in devotional service. And in this way, I will not be swayed from my determination. And I understand that this acquisition of great opulence is not the goal of life, and it's a waste of my time. And the real purpose of life is to develop spiritual awareness, and that's what I'm going to do. So he betook himself to engaging in spiritual activity. However, his past didn't go away because, you know, he had taken to the platform of renunciation. He was haunted by his past, that people from his village, they said, oh, look at this man. You know, we know who he was. We know that he was a great miser. We know that he was a great enjoyer. Now he's pretending to be some kind of renunciate. And we know that he is, in the Bhagavatam it says, we know that he is a great renunciate, just like a duck or something like that. They reviled him in unkind words. And sometimes people would taunt him while he would beg for something to eat. People would come and pass water in the bowl that he was been given some tiny remnants by somebody to eat, and they would urinate in his bowl. Sometimes people would catch him and chain him to a tree. Sometimes people would take away his begging bowl and refuse to give it back to him and taunt him in many various ways. And so he was enduring all these things. And he was never angry because he could understand this is my own past and it's coming back to me. And that's, you know, that whole section, we get this nice verse. What is it? If I can think of it. Well, maybe it'll come to me in a minute. It's along these same lines that one one has to tolerate the one who tolerates the results or the effects of his past sinful life, all the while glorifying the Lord with body, mind, and words, such a person is a suitable candidate for liberation because it is his right. Yeah, tat tenu kampam shushamik shamanam bunjane bhatma kritam vipakam hridvagba purbir vididandamaste jivete yu mukti pare sataya bhaka. I believe is how that verse goes. So, where is that? In this, what part of Bhagavatam?
I think it's 8th, I'm not, I think 8th or 9th.
Yeah, somewhere like that. Tatenu kampam shushamik shamanam bunjane bhama kritam vipakam hridvagva purbir vididandamaste jivete yumukti parisantaya bhak. That one who glorifies the Supreme Lord all the while tolerating the effects of his past bad misbehavior, such a person is a suitable candidate for liberation, because it has become his rightful share. So we may change our consciousness, we may change our course in life, but that doesn't mean that Krishna writes off everything. The material world is designed to harass us no matter who we are. We can be small, we can be older, we can be man, we can be woman, we can be saintly, we can be demoniac, we can be powerful, we can be completely bereft, and the material world will still harass us, no matter who we are. because the material world doesn't play favorites. It harasses everybody. And when we experience the difficulties that come upon us, we can recognize that actually they are coming from our past misbehavior. So rather than, you know, become angry, we can recognize that this is actually the result of my past misbehavior. It's coming upon me. And I should tolerate this. And all the while, I should glorify the Supreme Lord. One who does this is a suitable candidate for liberation because it has been his rightful share, Dayabhak. Evidently, this word means in Sanskrit that like a son inherits his father's property, that someone who has this mentality, tolerating their own past karma or their past due that comes as a result of the progress of time, and at the same time is steady in carrying out their devotional activities, such a person wins the favor of the Lord. And again we see this theme that adversity sometimes is a very positive thing. It brings us, as we learned yesterday, to a feeling for the Supreme. And so here in this verse, Kunti is saying, Janmaishvarya Shuta Shribhir Edamana Madapuman Naivarhati Abhidhatum Vaitvam Akinchana Gocharam, that Krishna is the property of the Akinchana Gocharam, people who have nothing. And those who are on the edge, those who are in desperation, they can feelingly call out to the Supreme Lord. But one who has what appears to be a material stable position cannot so feelingly call out. So sometimes the Lord does that. He brings a person to that stage. It's not that you have to be at the bottom of the heap to call out to the Lord. Sometimes we can understand that even if we do have some kind of opulence or we do have some kind of stable situation, it could vanish at any moment because there's nothing certain about this world. And that's the way things are. And if we honestly understand that, then we have, even in the midst of opulence, we recognize that Krishna is still there and we need to call out to him. Because if one does have material opulence, the tendency to misuse it becomes greater and greater. And we see that there are many stories like that in the Vedas, that Ravana was given all kinds of material opulence. Originally, he wasn't that opulent, but his mother urged him to perform penances and get benedicted by Brahma. So Ravana went with Vibhishan and with Kumbhakarna, and they performed difficult austerities. And they were served, actually, by Suparnika. They were served by her sister. And for, 10,000 years, Ravana performed these difficult austerities. And he was hoping that Brahma would come and give him whatever benediction he desired. And when Brahma didn't come after 1,000 years, he cut off one of his 10 heads. And then another 1,000 years went by, and Ravana cut off the second of his 10 heads. And so in 9,000 years, he was down to one head. And so he was about to cut off the last head. And that's when Brahma showed up. And, he gave him whatever benediction he wanted, and that's when Ravana asked for the benediction, that he could not be killed by any demigod or demon or any powerful being. But he didn't ask the benediction of not being killed by humans because he considered them too insignificant to worry about getting a benediction against. So that was his downfall. But as soon as Ravana got the benedictions immediately, he started doing all kinds of nasty things. So he stole the... he attacked his brother, or his half-brother, Kubera, and took over Lanka, and actually created all kinds of problems, and took his Pushpaka airship and began like a teenager to go for a joyride in a stolen car. So he he traveled all over in Kuvera's airship. And then, you know, he'd gotten his benediction from Brahma. So he came to Kailas Mountain. And Lord Shiva and his wife were meditating on Kailas Mountain. And Ravana, with his many arms, he lifted Kailas Mountain, started to move it. And Parvati became disturbed. She asked her husband, "What is this? Is some earthquake or something?" And Lord Shiva replied to Parvati that, "No, my dear wife, this I can see is Ravana. He has been puffed up with benedictions by Lord Brahma. So he is creating this disturbance." So Parvati then cursed Ravana, saying, "Because he has frightened me so much, then I curse him that his death will come as a result of being involved with a woman." And of course, that would happen. But then Lord Shiva, he stood on Mount Kailash and pressed it down. And because Ravana was holding up the mountain, it squished down on Ravana, and Ravana was trapped underneath Kailash Mountain. And he couldn't move. And so all of his demon friends were up in the Pushpaka airplane. They're wondering, "What's happening to Ravana?" They noticed that time was going by, so they went and they saw Ravana squished under the mountain. And they approached Ravana and they said, "Ravana, what happened to you?" And he said, "Well, it appears Shiva has trapped me underneath Mount Kailash because I arrogantly lifted the mountain." And so they said to Ravana, "Oh, Ravana, you should offer nice prayers to Lord Shiva. He will be happy and he will release you for sure." So Ravana offered prayers, and that went on for 100 years or something like that. He had to offer a lot of prayers. So Ravana offers all these prayers. Finally, Lord Shiva appears to Ravana. And he says, "Ravana, you know, don't do this again." And he let Ravana go from out from under the mountain. So we see that when people have a lot of power or wealth, the tendency for that to go to one's head is very great. And one must always think that if I have some opulence at my disposal or I have some position, I have to be very careful to use it in the proper way. And that's why we have to be very scrupulous in chanting the holy name and trying to serve, recognizing that nothing belongs to me. Because actually, at any moment, the whole situation could change. And, you know, we see any time one gets some opulence, they can misuse it. So not only Ravana, but there were many other examples of, you know, we see Hiranyakashipu, he had also benediction, he immediately misused it. Anytime someone's wealthy or strong or powerful, then immediately the tendency is to misuse that wealth, strength, or power. And because it gets misused, one creates a problem for himself and for others. But someone who has nothing realizes that at every moment they are dependent on the mercy of the Lord. So Tvam Akinchana Gocharam, you are the property of those who are materially exhausted. And Krishna cannot be approached by those who have opulence and are convinced that the purpose of life is to use that opulence in their own material happiness. So as long as the hope, the faith that material happiness is existing, is there in the heart, one will not take to spiritual life. As long as one is convinced that we need to increase our opulence, our at janma, one's birth, aishvarya, their opulence, shruta, one's learning, shribir, one's beauty, as long as one is interested in increasing those things, then one will not take spiritual life seriously. But someone who gives those things up, they can take spiritual life seriously. So your name can be feelingly uttered by people who recognize they have no shelter other than you. The next verse also gives a similar conception. Namo kinchana vitaya nivritta guna rit atmaramaya shantaya kaivalya pataye namaha. My obeisances unto you who are the property of the materially impoverished. You have nothing to do with the actions and reactions of the material modes of nature. You are self-satisfied. And therefore you are the most gentle and are the master of the monists. So, Akinchana Gocharam in the last verse means who is easily approached by the materially exhausted. So here we have Akinchana Vitaya unto the property of the materially impoverished. So this is, of course, a state of mind. And it's interesting that in Srimad Bhagavatam, in the 10th canto, in the 88th chapter, there's this verse. Let me see. How does that one go? Yasyaham anugrinami harishe taddanam shanai. Tato danam tyajanti asya tvamakinchana gocharam. What's that?
Swajana dukkadukkitam.
Yeah, twajana dukkadukkitam, that's right. Yasyaham anugrinami harishe taddanam shanai. Tato danam tyajanti swad. Svajana dukkha dukkitam, right?
Tajantiasya svajana dukkha.
Yeah, svajanasya. So this verse says that Krishna is saying that whoever I bestow my special mercy upon, that person I remove all their material opulence, and that materially impoverished person has nowhere to turn but me. And he becomes friendly to my devotees. So that's part of an interesting story, because that whole chapter, the 88th chapter of the 10th canto, describes a question that Maharaj Parikshit. He asks this question to Sukadeva Goswami. Maharaj Parikshit says in the beginning of that chapter, "My dear Sukadeva Goswami, Lord Shiva is a renunciate, and he has nothing. On the other side of the coin, Lord Vishnu is the husband of the goddess of fortune, and he has great opulence. Yet we see that the worshippers of Lord Shiva are materially opulent, and the worshippers of Vishnu have nothing. Why is it the opposite of what you would expect?" So he's asking this question. And Sukadeva Goswami replies, "Yes, you have asked a very excellent question. And this question was asked by Yudhishthir to Krishna himself." So evidently Krishna had been approached by Yudhishthir. asking the same question, why people worship Lord Shiva and Lord Shiva's renunciate, and those people who worship Lord Shiva become opulent, and why people worship Lord Vishnu, who has everything, and they approach him and they become bereft. So it seems to be the opposite of what you would expect. And so Lord Krishna answers Yudhishthira with this verse, yasya hamanubhinami harishye taddanam shanai. What is it? I've never really focused in on the last two lines, but I tried to do that yesterday. What is it? Dhanam chajanti asya swajana dukadukitam. That's how it works, right? Svajana dukadukitam. That someone I bestow my special favor on them, I remove all their material opulence, and the poor wretched man who has nothing is abandoned by his family and so suffers one misery after another. And then in the next verse he says, he has nowhere to turn but my devotees. And so by associating with my devotees, he becomes actually benefited. Same theme, you know. And then, of course, this chapter goes on that Krishna describes the whole pastime of Vrikasura. That Vrikasura was also, like Ravana, a great demon. And he approached Narada Muni. He met Narada Muni. And he asked Narada Muni, which of the demigods is the easiest to give benedictions? You can see already he had a certain plan going. And so Narada Muni said, actually, you know, Vishnu is difficult to approach. But Shiva and Brahma, they usually give benedictions more easily. Especially Lord Shiva, he's said to be Ashutosh. He is easily angered and easily pleased. So I suggest you approach Lord Shiva. So Vrikasura, he went to perform his version of a sacrifice, which he started a sacrificial fire, and he offered some prayers to Lord Shiva, and he was cutting pieces of his own flesh and throwing them into the fire, because he thought that Lord Shiva would be impressed with that and come. And when Lord Shiva didn't show up, he became morose, and he wasn't getting the benediction of Lord Shiva. So he dipped his head in the holy waters, and then with the hair still wet, he got a knife and he was about to cut off his head. And when he did that, then Lord Shiva came and stopped him. And it says he stopped him just as any ordinary man would from killing himself by cutting off his head. And he said, my dear Vrikasura, why are you performing these egregious austerities? It's not necessary. I'm pleased with just an offering of some water and some Vedic mantras. But Vrikasura said, I was seeking a benediction from you. And Lord Shiva said, well, what benediction would you like to have? And Vrikasura replied that, I would like the benediction that anyone whose head I touch will immediately crack into 1,000 pieces. And so Lord Shiva could understand that that was not exactly a very nice benediction, but he said Om and allowed Vrikasura to get that benediction. And of course, immediately upon getting that benediction, Vrikasura thought, well, Shiva has a very attractive wife, Parvati, so maybe I'll see if this benediction works, so I'll crack Shiva's head. So he went to chase after Lord Shiva. So Lord Shiva is running away from Vrikasura, who he has just given a benediction for, too. So you can see what mentality Vrikasura had. He was the wicked son of Shakuni. I don't know. It's probably a different Shakuni than the one that's in the Mahabharata. He had no good qualities. So he, immediately after getting a benediction from Lord Shiva, instead of feeling a little bit, you know, indebted to Lord Shiva, he decides he's going to eliminate Lord Shiva. So he begins to chase Lord Shiva, and Lord Shiva's running away from him, and Lord Shiva runs everywhere, even to the edge of the universe. And so Lord Shiva runs to Vishnu and asks Lord Vishnu to protect him from this Vrikasura. And so Lord Vishnu says, all right, I will protect you. And he appears as this little Brahmana boy, this Brahmachari. And Vrikasura is running, and the Brahmachari, he says, oh, sir, why are you running so fast? You must be getting tired. We should not overexert the body. The body also sometimes needs rest. And so Vrikasura was kind of pleased by the Brahmachari, and the Brahmachari said, please tell me what is your business, because I may be able to help you. I know some mantras, and possibly I can be of assistance to you. And so hearing this kind of speech from the Brahmachari, Vrikasura began to listen to what the Brahmachari had to say. And the Brahmachari said, one should always be very careful in what one does, and I see that you are engaged in some great effort. What is it you hope to accomplish? And so Vrikasura began to tell him the whole story about how he'd been given a benediction by Lord Shiva, and how he was chasing Lord Shiva, and how he hoped to put his hand on Lord Shiva and have Lord Shiva's head crack. And then the Brahmachari just began to laugh. And Vrikasura was kind of disturbed. Why is the Brahmachari laughing at me? And he said, "What? Why are you laughing at me?" And the Brahmachari said, "Oh, I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing that you took what Lord Shiva said seriously." He said, "Well, why shouldn't I take it seriously? He's a demigod." And I asked Narada Muni. He said he gives benedictions and so forth. And the Brahmachari said, but you don't know what happened recently, that Daksha had this big sacrifice, and Lord Shiva's wife, Sati, went, and she killed herself in the sacrifice by emulating herself. And so ever since that happened, Lord Shiva's been a little funny in the head, and he says all kinds of crazy things. So he told you that you could have a benediction to crack anybody's head. I don't think that's true. Vrikasura said, no, he gave me a benediction that I can crack anybody's head. And the Brahmachari said, believe me, it isn't like that. You didn't get any benediction. Shiva gives out all kinds of benedictions, and people find that they're being swindled by him. I think that, you should kill him. You won't be able to kill him by touching him on the head, but he's a liar, and you should put an end to his lying. But, you know, if you think that this benediction is actually real, touch your head, and you'll see nothing will happen. And, of course, Vrikasura, without thinking, touched his head, and it split into a million pieces. So in this way, Vrikasura was finished by his own greed. So he got some opulence, and immediately he put it to the wrong utility. And that's the general thing, that people who are materially directed, people who are materially full of material desires, such people will not know what to do with their Janma Aishvarya Shruta or Shribir. They will do the wrong thing with their, good birth, with their opulence, their material wealth. They will do the wrong thing with their learning. They'll do the wrong thing with their beauty. So one should recognize that the Supreme Lord is actually the one who can help us. And whatever we have at our disposal, we should use that in Krishna's service. And then there's no possibility of misusing our opulence or our wealth or our learning or our beauty or whatever it is, you know. We won't misuse it. And then we can be in charge of so much wealth or beauty or learning. So that's basically the moral of the story. We have to use everything properly. And Krishna is especially there. And of course, in one sense, that's the first installment of Krishna's mercy, that he takes things away. Later on, he may give everything because he knows a devotee will not misuse things. So there's stories of Krishna giving opulence. There's the story of Dhruva, that Dhruva had been insulted by his stepmother, Suruchi. So his mother, Suniti, was not the favorite queen of King Uttanupad. And because Dhruva tried to climb on the lap of Maharaj Uttanupad, Suruchi happened to be in the room, and she told Dhruva that you cannot climb on your father's lap because you were not born from my womb. To be qualified, you have to die and take birth in my womb. Then you can actually become eligible to get your father's association. And because Uttanupad was somewhat henpecked, he didn't say anything, and Dhruva took this as a great insult. He went to his wife, his mother crying, Suniti, and he asked her, my dear mother, our father has not accepted me, and your co-wife has told me that I'm not fit to sit on my father's lap. So I want to have a kingdom better than my father's. And how do I get the association of the Supreme Lord so he can benedict me that I have the kingdom better than my father's? And so Suniti told her son that he should go to the forest. And so that's what Dhruva did. He went to the forest. Of course, he met Narada Muni, and Narada Muni said, you are just a young boy. You're only 5 years old. You're too young to be thinking about kingdoms and these kind of insults. Just go back home, and things will be all right. And Dhruva said, I heard your instruction, but I'm afraid I cannot follow it. My mind is determined. So please tell me what I can do. And so Narada Muni said, well, if you're actually keen on getting the association of the Supreme, then you should go to the forest and meditate on the name of the Supreme Lord. And then the Supreme Lord will appear. So that's what Dhruva did. He went to Madhavan, and there he meditated, and he called the name of the Supreme, and he began to perform very difficult austerities. He didn't eat anything, and finally the Supreme Lord appeared to him. And when Dhruva saw the Supreme, at first he couldn't say anything because he was overwhelmed with seeing the Supreme Lord Vishnu. And then Vishnu touched him on the head with his conch shell, and Dhruva began to offer nice prayers. And Dhruva began to realize, he said, I have come to you for a material benediction, but now I am ashamed. I do not want a material benediction. Rather, I want to become your servant. And Vishnu said, yes, you can become my servant, but nevertheless, you will get your benediction. So Dhruva was benedicted that he would have a kingdom better than his father's, than Uttanupad. And at the same time, he would remain a devotee. So if one is a devotee, then one can manage wealth appropriately. But otherwise, the tendency is to be swept away by one's apparent position, one's apparent wealth, and so forth. So I'll stop there.
Mm-hmm. Maharaj Dhruva also got the planet, which will never be annihilated.
Yeah, he got Dhruva Loka, with that planet, which will never be annihilated, even if they were. And all the other planets revolve around it, the pole star.
You mentioned that Raman, he was the half-brother of Kubera.
Yeah.
So, can you explain it a little bit?
There, Kubera, who was the father of Ravana?
Vishrava.
And Vishrava had more than one wife. One of them was Kaikasi or something like that. That was Ravana's mother, and Kubera's mother is a different... I don't remember what her name is. But Kaikasi was actually envious of Kuvera's wealth and all of his opulence. So she suggested for her son Ravana to go and perform austerities to get a benediction for Brahma, that he could do something more than his brother. And that's why, Ravana, he took Kumbhakarna and Vibhishana, and they all performed austerities for 10,000 years. And finally they got a benediction for Brahma. Each one had a different benediction. That, Ravana wanted the benediction not to be killed. Kumbhakarna, he wanted the benediction of, what was it, Nishdevata or something like. It was the...
Nishdevatam,
to get rid of all the demigods or something like that. But he actually said the word wrong, because the demigods understood what he was trying to go for. So Sarasvati appeared on Kumbhakarna's tongue, and instead he asked for the benediction to sleep. And so instead of getting the benediction to kill all the demigods, Kumbhakarna got the benediction that he would spend most of his life sleeping. And Vibhishana asked for the benediction for pure devotional service. So we can see that they have very different mentalities, So that's how the whole episode came out. But that's, because we just had, Ram Nomi. So I was reading that section in the Ramayana about the benedictions of Ravana.
Thank you. Just one
question.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Dhruva's story, when he could not sit on his father's lap,
mm-hmm.
So the first time, Suruji himself challenges him, right, saying that you cannot sit on your father's lap unless you take the blessings of Lord Vishnu. So I'm just trying to understand, remember the story, but she was the first one who said that, correct?
Well,
and then later on, Suniti said, yeah, what she said is right, so you go.
Well, she basically said that he couldn't sit on the lap unless he takes birth in her womb. I don't remember the part. It might be there that she told him that he had to pray to Lord Vishnu to be eligible to take birth in her womb, but maybe that's also there, but I don't remember that part. But I do know that Dhruva was very upset by the whole episode. So when he explained what had happened to his own mother, to Suniti, then she told him, don't wish ill for anybody. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, she told him, if you really want a benediction, then you should go to the forest, because in the forest, that's where sages go, and they meet the Supreme Lord in the forest, and therefore you can meet the Supreme Lord and get a benediction. So she told him like that. Then he met Narada Muni on the way to the forest, and Narada Muni told him to forget about it because he was just 5 years old. And Dhruva said, I'm afraid your instruction doesn't stand in my heart. I need a different instruction. And so then Narada Muni said, well, if you're really serious about going to the forest, then you chant the name of the Supreme Lord and you go to a holy place, and there the Supreme Lord will appear to you. And that's what Dhruva did. And that's when he met the Supreme Lord. Then he was ashamed that he had actually gone through all that austerity just for a material benediction. And he says that, I was looking for broken glass, but you have actually given me the real jewel of devotional service. And So the Supreme Lord said, you are certainly eligible for devotional service, but I will also give you a kingdom better than your father's. So that's a kind of opposite thing where somebody is not having all their wealth taken away, but benedicted by the Supreme Lord to get the most wealth you can imagine. And I was thinking of something else, but it flitted away. I can't remember it now. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Sorry, Maharaj. One quick question.
Oh, yeah, a quick question.
So all these demons, they were asking for benediction, and they knew they were asking benediction from the demigods.
Mm-hmm.
Do they know they're asking from demigods?
Yeah, yeah.
So at the same time, do they know that there is a supreme, and they were envy of him, and they're trying to go against the supreme?
Yeah, well, they see some things, but not other things. You know, we see that, in Ravana's case, he's approaching Lord Brahma. In Hiranyakashipu's case, he's approaching Lord Brahma. We see sometimes they approach Lord Shiva, sometimes they... usually they approach Brahma or Shiva. So it's known that one can get benedictions. And if one gets a benediction, then one can use those benedictions in some kind of material effort to lord it over the universe. At the same time, they're also envious of the demigods, so they want to take over the demigods' kingdom. But Brahma's kind of out of sight because he's got his own planet up there. The other demigods are more visible to them. So the demons are always seeking to capture the Amaravati, you know, the place where the demigods stay. Their own kingdom, the subterranean heavenly planets, Bila Swarga, are actually, even in one sense, more opulent than the place where the demigods are. But the reason that the demons want to overtake the heavenly planets is the heavenly planets are the control center for the universe. So the demons want to control the universe, which they can do from the heavenly planets. They can't do that from their own Bila Swarga location. So the earth is in between the two, and that's why demons come to the earth, so they can be in a good strategic position to attack the heavenly planets. And that's why they were adventing themselves on the earth, and why Bhumi Devi was sending out the distress call to Brahma, and Brahma approached the ocean of milk, and they began to perform the Purusha Shukta, and therefore Vishnu replied to Brahma that he would come soon. So that's kind of a view about the demigods and their planets and that kind of thing. Was that your question, or did I miss it?
Yeah, that, and then so they knew that this is he. They are always going and getting the benediction from the demigods. So
yeah.
They didn't know at that time if they are going against the demigods, and then demigod is going to the supreme and praying to come down and annihilate them.
Yeah.
With the benediction from the demigod, how they are going to go against the supreme?
Yeah, well, they don't know that.
They had that covering completely. You know, they're puffed up.
They see everything from a material point of view. They think that people have certain power, and that power is somehow theirs. In Bhagavad Gita, we learn that one who thinks himself the only doer does not see things as they are. Basically, whatever we have at our disposal is the mercy of the Supreme. Krishna says also that I'm the strength of the strong, and I'm the intelligence of the intelligent. We find that in Bhagavad Gita. The demons never think like that, though. They think that I am my own intelligence, I am my own strength, and that everything is mine. So they do not see past the idea that they have some kind of prowess on their own. And through that prowess, they seek to sub, to cause everyone else to submit to them. And then they feel themselves happy. And of course, as we were saying last night, that's the God project, that you want to prove not only to yourself but to the whole world that you actually are in the position of God. You know, you want to take God out of the center. You want to put your own picture there. And so that's the way the demons think. And they just see everything as supporting that basic idea that they have, you know, that I can control everything by getting this benediction, by performing this sacrifice, by doing that. And they see it all in a very materialistic way. Yeah.
I don't know the exact question.
What, in Ravana's family, was like the whole family Rakshasas, or was he the first Rakshas?
That's a good question. I don't know. Generally, we don't think of Kuvera as a Rakshasa, but I don't know Vishrava. I don't know much about him. Lately, I got a Puranic encyclopedia, so I can look some of these things up.
He was Brahmana.
What was that?
He was a Brahmana.
Yeah, Brahmana. But how does Ravana become a Rakshasa? Is Kaikasi a Rakshasa?
Kaikasi was not a Brahmin. She was a lower.
Uh-huh.
So it was
what
we call the Pratiloma Aniloma.
Yeah, Prati. So well, yeah, but she has several names, but one of the names mentioned in the Puranic Encyclopedia is Kaikasi. She was his mother. And she was... It's also confusing because in what I read, at one point it says that she had four children, you know, which was, of course, Ravana, Kumbhakarna, Vibhishana, and Suparnaka. But in another place it says that they weren't all her children, that only Ravana and Kumbhakarna were her children, but the other two were from some other wife of Vishrava. You know. So, you know, and though Ravana was a definitely, usually, was he a Rakshasa, actually?
I know he was a king. He became cannibal.
His nature was like
that. Yeah, his nature was like that. He was the king of the Rakshasa, but whether he himself was, he had, you know, 10 heads and all that, and after the benediction of Brahma, you know, his heads would regrow and all that kind of thing. But, you know, Kuvera is the ruler also of all the Yakshas.
Yeah.
And so that's when, you know... in the Ramayana, mentions that when Kuvera first set up his rule, he set it up in Lanka, and that's where he was ruling all the Yakshas and Rakshasas. And because, you know, his rule was very opulent, many Rakshasas and Yakshas came from the subterranean heavenly worlds where usually they stay, and they began to live in Lanka. And then, of course, when Ravana took it over, then, you know, Ravana continued with ruling of the Rakshasas. And maybe he himself wasn't a Rakshasa in the same sense, you know, that they were. Because Rakshasas are generally characterized as being very large. They're giants. And they eat humans, you know. I'm not sure whether that is what Ravana did or
not. He did. I heard he did eventually.
Oh, okay.
Maybe. Once he got the opulence, he became totally different, like.
Yeah. Well, you know, he became degraded, but he might not have been one by his genetic or his family line, you know. But he was certainly not a good sort of bloke, as they say.
Sometimes demons can, devotees can appear in demoniac, like Prahlad Maharaj, yeah, Maharaj.
Yeah. Yeah,
they're in the Daitya family, but they're devotees, nonetheless. Yeah. And they're great devotees.
Sometimes the other thing happens. It could even appear in what appear to be devotee families. And but that just shows that the Supreme does things the way he wants to do them. And sometimes he wants to set the stage in an interesting way for an interesting drama to take place.
Even Hiranyakashipu was Brahmin, but... because his father was a Brahmin, his mother also was a Diti, so he was also a Brahmin.
Yeah.
He became...
But Diti was from Daitya's family.
Huh?
Diti.
Yeah.
Diti, they're from Daitya family.
Daitya family?
Yeah.
No, Diti was not. Diti was a daughter of...
She's one of the daughters of Daksha, right?
Daksha?
Daksha had...
They were sisters.
Yeah, sisters.
Yeah, they were sisters and co-wives, right?
Prasuti, Devahuti, they were all sisters.
Right. Yeah, oh, Prasuti, Devahuti...
Oh, that's
those are that's Karamuni. That's a different thing, I think. But,
Kashyap Muni's wife.
Yeah, but Kashyap Muni had I think 13 or 14 wives or something like that, and they were all, as I remember, they were daughters of Daksha. That's what Daksha first had, the Haryashas, his 10,000 sons, and Narada Muni preached to them, and they became celibate. And then he had 1,000 more sons of Shavalashvas, and Narada Muni preached to them, and they also became celibate. And so Daksha was pretty frustrated, and he cursed Narada Muni that he couldn't stay anywhere longer than it takes to milk a cow. And so Daksha got intelligent and decided to have girls, because he knew that Narada Muni wouldn't preach to them to become celibate. So he had, as I recall, something like 50 daughters, and they were given to various sages. And as I remember, 13 of them were given to Kashyap, and Diti was one, Aditi was another. And, you know, there's all these different daughters, and they all had various children except for Diti, you know, and that's why she was complaining to Kashyap. And, you know, of course, they lay together at the wrong time, and Shiva was... traveling, and as a result, Kashyapa warned her that the child would not be a good child. And so, of course, that child became not one child, but two, Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaraksha.
That way they're also Brahmins.
Yeah. So it sounds like, you know, he has a Brahmin background, but he's obviously not behaving like that.
I wasn't going to ask this question, Maharaji, but I'm going to ask...
Okay.
When I was going through Srimad Bhagavatam, almost everybody has 100 wives, 200 wives.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Why is that? Well, we're usually talking about kings. The idea usually was that kings had more than one wife. And
sages.
What's that?
Even sages.
Sometimes we see that sages did too. One of the ideas is that, at least with kings, that kings are very powerful. And as a result of being very powerful, they're very much in the mode of passion. So they supposedly need the company of many ladies to keep that passion going. And the other part of it is practical, that, you know, a king can be killed easily. And that's his whole duty, to be constantly on the line. So therefore, kings need lots of descendants so that the kingly line isn't extinguished in some kind of battle. Of course, all those things don't make sense in our modern time. And Prabhupada himself, you know, although the Vedas allow plural marriage, Prabhupada was seriously against it, you know, because he thought that, you know, on the one side of the coin, you hear these stories about kings having many wives, but at the same time you hear stories about how those wives get into things with one another and they create problem. You know, the whole story with Dasarath and, you know, his wives, and the whole story, you know, with Chitraketu and his wives. You know, you see that although it's allowed, it usually gets you in trouble. And same thing with hunting in the forest. Although Kshatriyas can do it, it seems to get them in trouble, you know. So you get this kind of double message that do it, but do it at your own risk, you know.
Lord Rama, he kind of...
Yeah, well, he had the Ekapatni Vrata, you know, that he would just take one wife. But Prabhupada made the statement that devotee men should never think like that, you know, that's something for a bygone era. And, you know, a kshatriya could actually support many queens. He had the opulence and the ability to do it, whereas ordinary men cannot do that. And when we're talking about the early people that are the beginners of the universe, there's a lot of stuff that doesn't apply because things are very different at that time when the progenitors are trying to populate the universe. That's their main purpose, is to kind of fill the universe with population. So the Prajapatis are given special facility to just for that purpose. That's what they're trying to do. And then later on, it's not so much, you know, that's not what's operating anymore. Then, you know, population's continuing on the way we usually think of it as doing. You know, the procreation happens the way it generally does, you know. But in the beginning, procreation happens in some unusual ways, like Brahma creating from his body and, you know, the wives of Kasyapa giving birth to creatures that don't look like them, like the insects and the you know, plants and things like that. So that's actually our answer to the Darwinian conception, is that these various forms that we see around us of different kinds of animals, different kinds of plants, these forms come from the daughters of Daksha and the wives of Kasyapa, that they create, you know, the plants, the insects, the wild animals, the humans, the demigods, the demons. Each one has, you know, a different group that she and Kasyapa generate. And that was one of the functions that Kasyapa and his wives are destined to do, is to fill the universe with various categories of living species. Okay, so I think we can end at this point. Thank you all very much, Hare Krishna.
Yay.
Yeah,
I'm going to go to the house.